And I hear everybody say that things are different today. Was it in that time? Or was it only yesterday? I saw you standing in the rain. And nothing's been the same since you came around. You came around, round, round, yeah. I've been walking on the sun. I just closed my eyes.
Hello and welcome to episode 8 of the Tools of Ignorance podcast. I am Hudson Belinsky. Joining me, as always, the Canadian, Jonah Bierenbaum. Jonah, how are you today?
I'm okay, but you've reduced me to my nationality, American Hudson Belinsky.
Yeah, I have this thing. I think everyone whose name is Jonah is Canadian.
And handsome.
Yeah, that's the next sentence. I don't even need to finish my thought.
It's a prerequisite. I mean, you know, they don't just hand this name out haphazardly, you know?
There's an application process.
Yeah, it's a whole ordeal.
Yes.
It's not fun. It's a lot of, painstaking work.
Yeah, my dad actually takes credit for a lot of my accomplishments, saying that... things that I do are made easier by the fact that my name is so obscure. So being named Hudson apparently has tremendously helped me in life.
Yeah. I mean, you got a bay and a river named after you. So that's, a pretty big accomplishment.
Yeah. And we're still waiting out on an ocean. But, you know, we'll see how it goes. You know, I have a few more years left on this planet. And if I could make a name for myself enough to get the ocean, then that's the trifecta. So
there you go. I love it.
I love it, too. So,
but
Jonah,
baby steps, you know? Let's be reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I guess I can wait a couple years to have an ocean named after me. Do you want to talk about baseball?
Let us discuss some baseball.
So Dan Haran is the first guy we're going to talk about. Dan the Man Haran, $13 million for 1 year, going to the Washington Nationals. Initial impressions of this deal?
Yeah, I mean, I was a little surprised that Dan Haran would settle. I mean, it's not a traditional rebuild value contract because he's getting $13 million, but I'm a little bit surprised at the length of the deal. I thought he would get multiple years. And I mean, for the Nationals, I kind of like it because now they probably have the best rotation in the National League. And Haran, considering the way his velocity's declined a little bit and how he's not exactly as dominant a force he was in previous years, he'll slot in very nicely into the four spot in that rotation. And now, I mean, you look at them 1 through 4, it's going to be Strasburg, Gio, Jordan Zimmermann, and Dan Haran. I mean, that's pretty darn good. And I mean, I think that his regression might have been a little bit overblown last year. I mean, don't get me wrong. He struggled, and the home run rates went up, and the walk rates went up a little bit. But, I mean, his strikeout rate was pretty much the same. It was virtually identical in 2012 as it was in 2011. I mean, he did miss time with injuries, and I think that's a concern that's legitimate. But, I mean, you know, I think Dan Haran will thrive in sort of a less pressure job, so to speak, pitching out of that. I mean, really, the order of your pitchers is inconsequential, but I think that he'll be the fourth best starter in that rotation, and I think that he'll perform quite well in that spot. What were your thoughts?
I think it's great for Dan Haran. I think he is going to be a free agent again in a year, and I think there was probably a good amount of pessimism that he could stay healthy in negotiations and talks with teams, and so he figured, you know what, I can up my value and get to where I was had I been a free agent before 2012. And so now Dan Haran has this excellent, excellent deal where he's going to make $13 million next year, and he has the opportunity to turn his season into a nice paycheck again in a year. So I think it's a good deal for Haran. It's a great deal for the Nationals. They get another... Really, it really is a low risk deal because, you know, what can you lose? It's $13 million, which in the grand scheme of a baseball economy is not that much money. And so you know, it just seems like a perfect deal for the Nationals and for Dan Herron.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's definitely mutually beneficial. And like I said, it's not your traditional rebuild value contract because it's, I mean, it's sort of the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's getting $13 million this year, and that's, you know, a substantial amount of money. And if he performs well, he's in for a huge payday, as you mentioned. So, yeah, I think we're in agreement here that it was a good deal for both sides, and he will probably perform pretty well in the National League.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Jonas, so there are a number of other players who have signed or have not signed. Which direction would you like to head in?
Yeah, let's go with the signees, but I'm actually curious. I want to ask you something. Are you surprised at how much action we've actually seen in the winter meetings? Because, I mean, traditionally, I mean, people have had expectations that stuff, a lot of stuff usually goes down at the winter meetings, but, you know, sometimes, you know, that sort of reputation hasn't been substantiated, and it's more of a environment to lay groundwork for future deals. So are you almost a little bit surprised at how much action we've seen in the first couple of days?
Kind of, yeah. It has been a lot of the trigger being pulled on a lot of guys, more so than, you know, than loading the gun. So what you see is, I think that might be a technological thing, where you have, if Mike Napoli wants to call up Ben Cherington, you know, that can happen. If he wants to shoot him a text, that can happen. And so I think that these negotiations are ongoing since, you know, since really the season ended. And then you get to the winter meetings, and everybody says, you know, this is as much as we're willing to pay, you know, take it or leave it. And there's also, it seems that with a lot of guys that have signed, it seems like there's just the top guy available seems to be falling pretty quickly. So you saw B.J. Upton's deal, and then you see that basically makes Michael Bourne and Pagan, the top center fielders, and so you have to compete for their talents, and whoever is going to be the highest bidder is going to get that. So the longer you wait to put in that bid, the potentially the higher that bid will get. So it seems to make sense with just the technology of it all, and with the scene today in this specific year with not a lot of talent at either position. So, you know, starting pitching is kind of the elite guys are the elite guys, and then there's a huge drop off. And so you see that really all over the field. I'm not really surprised by it because of those two reasons.
Mm-hmm. Remember 3 years ago when players would send snail mail requests to general managers and vice versa? I don't.
I guess that was the thing. And only having landlines where you couldn't call anyone unless you were home.
What a horrible world we used to live in, good sir.
Yeah. I want to kind of make a transition from a horrible world. Doesn't Alex Rodriguez own, like, slums? Where he just puts people in terrible living conditions and profits off of them.
Yeah, I think so. He's like a sleazy landlord who like charges exorbitant rent, and he knows that his tenants can't pay it, but they sort of have to.
Yeah,
I think that's the best analogy.
So, karma is not very nice to Alex Rodriguez because he just had hip surgery, or he didn't have it, but it was just announced that he will have hip surgery and miss a significant chunk of the 2013 season, if not all of the 2013 season. Now the Yankees may try to recoup some of the value of his contract. Apparently part of the contract is insured, so the Yankees won't be totally screwed.
But they're still a little screwed. Like, let's be real here.
This contract in terms of a player. Yeah.
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 I mean, this is just going from bad to worse. And we really saw how disillusioned the Yankees became with Alex Rodriguez last year. It all sort of culminated in the postseason when he was benched. And now I think it makes sense to assume that it was the hip injury that was bugging him and probably affecting his play to a certain degree. But, I mean, for the Yankees, this is just a disaster that's gone from bad to worse because they're on the hook for a significant amount of money. And Alex Rodriguez is, I mean, he's old. I mean, what do you want from him? He's put up, you know, almost two decades of an outstanding Hall of Fame career, and now he's at the tail end, and the contract that the Yankees signed him to, they probably went into it knowing that they weren't going to get value for their money towards the end of that contract, and those fears are being confirmed right now.
Yeah, and just going forward for the Yankees, they've now got this dilemma having both Jeter and A-Rod hurt, and so they are sort of forced to overpay for someone because they have no leverage really at all in any deal, because if they don't offer Jeff Kepinger what he wants, Jeff Kepinger can just not sign, you know, and they don't get anything. And so the Yankees really have to, you know, they're in a crappy position in terms of negotiating with guys who would have been depth otherwise. But now that this is out there, it kind of, yeah, you know, hurts them. And I wonder if they would have been better off just not announcing it and keeping this a little bit under the carpet until after the winter meetings and possibly picking up you know, another option. I wonder what the legality of that is too.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they chose now to sort of announce this is kind of perplexing, because it really does hurt them from a negotiation standpoint, because they don't have any leverage. You know, teams know that they're going to be on the hook for Alex Rodriguez and that he's not going to play. So it's nuts. But my question is, I mean, it's funny because Ben Lindbergh of Baseball Prospectus, he made a clever comment saying that Eric Chavez is now the more healthy third baseman on a team, which is a role that he's not traditionally been in. So I thought that was quite funny. But going forwards, I mean, do you think the Yankees are okay with Eric Chavez playing third base for them on an everyday basis, at least for the first few months of the season next year?
I think they have to be. Yeah. If you know, what's the better option, though? That's the thing. I know there is talk of moving Eduardo Nunez to third base, but yesterday or the day before, Brian Cashman said flat out that they view him as a shortstop and a guy who can play a little bit of third, but he's not a third baseman, everyday third baseman in their opinions. So, you know, what's going to happen there is it's going to be odd. I think you're going to see a mixture of guys who are kind of just hurt or very inconsistent, but have shown very promising things in the past. So you might see a Jeff Kepinger, or, you know, there are certainly middle infield options that, you know, could alleviate some of the stress in New York. But it's going to be very interesting to see how everything shakes out.
Yeah, I mean, the guys who are available on the free agent market, they probably don't inspire a whole lot of confidence. Probably not more than Eric Chavez after the year that Eric Chavez enjoyed last season, because he was actually quite good. And yeah. I mean, he only had 313 plate appearances, but he appeared in 113 games and he put up almost two wins above replacement. So he was quite good. I mean, obviously the fear is that he can stay healthy and he can sustain this level of productivity. But if he's able to do that, I think the Yankees won't have too much problem with that. But yeah, I agree with you. I think that they'd be kind of reluctant to try to convert Eduardo Nunez into a third baseman. I mean, even for a temporary period, given where he is in his career. But yeah, I mean, the options on the free agent market to upgrade at third aren't that, I mean, they're not overly appealing. So yeah, I think as of right now, they're sort of going with Chavez and almost waiting for an injury to, you know, resort to their contingency plan.
Okay, so moving on, the most baffling contract of this week for me has been Marco Scudero, who last night received 3 years and $20 million from the Giants, and he was a guy the Yankees were apparently in on. But Scudero, 3 years and $20 million, how long ago was this guy sort of just an extra piece at a trade deadline, and now he's a $20 million contract guy? It's so baffling to me.
Yeah, it's pretty ludicrous. And like the thing that occurs to me is, like, what about the reciprocal? Like, if Marco Scudero can get this kind of deal based on half a year and a good playoffs, You know, what's going to happen to Nick Swisher, who really struggled during the playoffs? Is that going to hurt his market value? It's absolutely crazy. I mean, you look at Marco Scudero's age and his body of work, and I mean, he's probably not deserving. He's unequivocally not deserving of a contract of this length, and probably not of that money either. I mean, and you look at how his numbers are trending. I mean, the walk rate's going down. You know, last year you could argue that, you know, he enjoyed more success at the plate because of a high batting average on balls in play. It was the largest of his career. Mm-hmm. Last year defensive metrics suggested that he was actually subpar at shortstop. So there are so many factors that really aren't playing in Scudero's favor, and yet he managed to get this kind of deal. But, like, that's the thing about the Giants. It seems like they sort of negotiate deals in this bizarro parallel universe where even contracts that don't make sense on paper turn out to be provide good value for the club, and then they go on to win the World Series.
Yeah, that's kind of what they do. That's their MO. But what I'm worried about with that team is over the next several years, the minor league system is kind of just okay. It's not particularly good. And so when guys like Scudero break down, because Scudero is going to be 40 when this deal's over, so it's likely that he'll break down. The team isn't particularly young, but over the next couple of years, when you need to go pick up that middle infielder on July 15th, what do they do? I don't see any. They don't have a lot of depth in the minor league system, and to get impact talent, like trading for a Hunter Pence, which was supposed to be an impact addition, I just don't think they have the pieces to make those types of things happen now. And so, going forward over the next several years, it starts to be this sort of long-term effect of continuing to give out contracts to the Marco Scuderos of the world and the Aubrey Huffs of the world. And so,
if I may interject, yes. Angel Pagans of the world.
Yes, Angel Pagan. So Angel Pagan got paid too, Jonah. 4 years, $40 million. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. And it's equally as baffling in my mind. I mean, look at his body of work. There's so many of these guys cashing in on career years, and it's typical Giants giving out money to a guy who probably doesn't represent the most sound investment. I mean, Angel Pagan is probably going to hit leadoff for them for the next foreseeable future. I mean, last year he was great. There's no question about it. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, for a leadoff guy, his strikeout rates are a little bit high. The walk rates aren't probably as good as you'd like. And, again, he's another batting average on balls in play phenomenon. So, yeah, this deal shocked me. I mean, obviously, a lot of his value is tied to his ability to steal bases and play defense. But, I mean, I don't know what your initial reaction was, but I was a little bit surprised at both the length and the dollar value.
I never like long-term deals, but I don't hate this one. I can kind of rationalize it in my head and see it paying off for the Giants, because he's going to play his age 31 through 34 seasons in this deal. He's going to probably be in that same neighborhood that he's been in the past few years in terms of on-base ability. He sat between 320 and 350, and it hasn't been a dramatic spike in either direction. He still has maintained that speed, even going into his early 30s now. He's still a decent center fielder. I can definitely see the justification for bringing Pagan back. 4 years, $40 million is pretty hefty, but I kind of think that if it wasn't Pagan, who was it going to be? Internally, Gary Brown, I don't think is a great option. I think he's kind of there's a lot of debate about his hit tool and how that's going to go. But then the next option for an impact player, or if you want to call Pagan that, but would be Michael Bourne. And Michael Bourne is, I would imagine that if Pagan's price tag was 4 years and 40, Bourne's must have totally blown the Giants out of the water. So it's just, with the way the market developed, I can kind of rationalize 4 years, $40 million for Angel Pagan.
Fair enough. And yeah, I agree. I think Michael Bourne is going to command a gazillion billion dollars just because, I mean, he's really, really good. There's no debating it. I mean, he plays premium defense. He's a fantastic guy to hit in the leadoff spot. And I'm really curious to see where he ends up because I think Michael Bourne is really, really a huge asset to add to the top of a team's lineup.
Yeah. Michael Bourne, him being traded, when the Astros traded him, I remember my reaction just being totally baffled by the package that they got back. They got Brett Oberholzer, who's like a 4-5 type, and then they got Jordan Schaefer, who was just totally abismal. Jordan Schaefer. But I guess 6 years of those guys makes a little bit of sense. But Michael Bourne was a dude, and he had a year and a half left on his contract. So, yeah. But I digress. Another thing we've seen happen, let's talk about the other team in New York. The New York Mets have...
There's another team in New York? Why wasn't I informed?
The Brooklyn Nets. The Mets have done a couple of different things. They've shopped R.A. Dickey very aggressively, and they've extended David Wright's contract for a long time and made him kind of Met for life, it appears. So whichever one you'd like to break down first, go.
Well, people who know me know that I am an unabashed David Wright enthusiast. I love David Wright. The contract for the Mets, considering where they are as an organization, I mean, it's a lot of money to throw out just on the hopes that he'll still be productive when they're a really competitive team and a legitimate contender. But, I mean, David Wright, his abilities speak for themselves. I mean, he is sort of the prototypical middle-of-the-lineup guy. And, I mean, he adds to that by being able to steal bases and by playing great defense at third base. I love David Wright. It's just the timing of the deal. I mean, I understand what the Mets were doing. They had to do this in order to keep David Wright. And, obviously, he was quite forthright in saying he wanted to remain a Met. And, they wanted to reward his loyalty with a long-term deal for a lot of money. But, you know, the fear is that will he still be able to produce these kind of numbers or at least even put up reasonable fractions of these numbers when they're a legitimate contender?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair question. David Wright has – there was the 1 year where David Wright was just bad and nobody could really explain why.
That was weird, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was – what year – pulling that up, it was 2011 – he was 254, 345, 427 slash, just 14 zippity doodahs there. It was kind of just a meh year, below average fielder, according to most metrics. But and then he comes back this year and he's just freaking David Wright-ish. Yeah. And so I can definitely see it happening. The down year makes sense. Those happen for players. But what's going to be really interesting is to see how playing in Citi Field is going to continue to affect him and hitting there. I do think that this is a deal that makes sense. I think that David Wright can be a viable part of this team competing for the next several years. So I can definitely justify this deal. And you look at the history of ginormous contracts that have been given out recently. They're not. David Wright's contract is not as bad as those. 8 years and $138 million. You look at that and you look at what Jason Worth got, and, you know, 8 years, $138 million looks great for David Wright. So I like the deal. I'm okay with it. And it's going to be fun to see how that plays out.
But isn't it almost perplexing, the sense that they extend David Wright to be a big part of their future, but now they're shopping R.A. Dickey fairly aggressively. That's what the report suggests, indicating that perhaps they're almost conceding the next few years. I mean, doesn't it almost seem like they're operating on two separate principles there?
You know, I think a lot of it is having guys like Zach Wheeler and Matt Harvey ready to step into the rotation. And so They look at R.A. Dickey as a guy whose value they can maximize or they can capitalize on now while it's at its highest, and potentially set themselves up for the future by trading Dickey, and then over the next year or two, really step in and be a competitor using the pieces they get in a potential Dickey deal.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that note, we have bent your ear for long enough, so we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be chatting with someone. Who that person is, you'll find out. Stick around. You're what I need. I don't want to know. No, I don't.
Getting close to anyone. Now that I'm alone. Now that I'm alone.
And welcome back to the Tools of Ignorance podcast. Joining us now, all the way from Nashville, Tennessee, we have President and CEO of Baseball Prospectus, Mr. Joe Hemrahi. Joe, how are you?
Hi, guys. How you doing?
We're doing good on our end. Not probably quite as hectic as you right now, running around that maze of a hotel, but we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
No problem at all. I thanks for having me on, guys. And yes, it definitely is a maze of a hotel. I mean, it's my first trip here and to this one, and it's easily the biggest hotel I've ever been at. So quite interesting.
Yeah, the rumors are true. That seems to be the consensus on Twitter, that it's just a crazy place to be. So Joe, just tell us a little bit about your experience over the past few days and sort of for those of us who don't have the privilege of attending the winter meeting, sort of what's going on down there and what you've been privy to.
Sure. Well, I mean, the hotel is the talk of a lot of people here, unfortunately, because there hasn't been a whole lot of real player movement or action. There's been some smaller, you know, free agent deals or smaller in the scheme of things in terms of who the players are, not necessarily the dollars. But there's been a lot of, you know, little rumored talk, but nothing that, you know, has been a big deal that we've heard, you know, prior years. And, you know, R.E. Dickey's thing seems to be standing out there for people to, you know, speculate about. And whether or not the Mets, you know, trade him or sign him, I think we're not going to know about that this week. I'm pretty sure about that. I think what's happening really here is teams are looking to see what's going to happen with Zach Greinke and what the market does with him and some of these other pitchers who maybe are tiered down, like the Brandon McCarthy's of the world. And what the market will set for them, because then it'll determine whether or not Dickey will be traded. Because whatever, even whether Dickey sees in the Mets or gets traded, is going to be, you know, this positioning is going to be to get an extension. So teams are going to gauge the interest based upon that. So that's kind of the big thing in play right now. The other big, you know, bit of news is that, you know, the Yankees don't have a third baseman and there are very few left. Mm-hmm. You know, the latest rumors are that, you know, there's some talk with Mark Reynolds. But, you know, that's, you know, it's, who knows at this point? The leverage, you know, the bargaining power now is all with the players when it comes to the Yankees. So it'll be interesting to see what they do there if they overpay for somebody, you know, trying to fill a position that's become very scarce at the moment. So that's kind of the beat on the baseball stuff. I mean, a lot of talks, a lot of people here. I mean, you know, it's as exciting as it always is in terms of what you expect from it. There's a lot of downtime, a lot of waiting around time. You know, there's certain plan things that go on here where they have managers come in from out of town and, you know, they all have little press conferences that are, you know, are prearranged and they say a lot of nothing. But it's a good time for everybody to get together in the industry. And it's one of those few times a year where, you know, everybody's in the same place and, you know, get to see each other and talk about what's going on. And there's some interesting stuff and there's some really good stuff going on for us at, you know, at Baseball Prospectus.
One thing you brought up briefly that we were talking about earlier on the show was how the Yankees have kind of are stuck in this pretty crummy negotiation spot, having no option at third base and having to scoop up one of these last ones available. What would you have thought if the Yankees kept this quieter and kept it out of the media for a few weeks? Because it seems like the Yankees probably could have made themselves or given themselves a significant amount more of leverage had they kept the news of A-Rod's needed surgery, you know, out of it.
You know, that's a good point. And honestly, I don't know if A-Rod started this, because I don't remember back to what how this all transpired, because we were all kind of running around when Cashman flew in on Monday. And he had the press conference as soon as he was basically in town. But I don't know if the news broke through A-Rod, who happened to just say something about it, or if the news came as a joint, you know, statement by the team and A-Rod, or if it was just the Yankees' decision. My guess is that it probably, given the situation now, how it seems to be, the way things are, you know, down to, you know, everyone's leaving town at their base side, I really think that it probably was A-Rod who opened his mouth, which doesn't shock me or anyone else in that manner, and it kind of opened the door where the Yankees had to kind of say something. You know, it's a difficult position to be in, but, you know, at this point of the game, the Yankees have other holes too, and I know that's going to be their, you know, their issue is, you know, have to fill his position, but I think that, you know, they can get by, you know, I guess they're projecting A-Rod to be out through June is what my understanding was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if they can fill that with somebody for half a season, that's why I really thought they would have, you know, really jumped on trying to keep Eric Chavez here. And that was kind of surprising to all of us that Chavez, you know, went to Arizona. So, it would definitely have been beneficial if they kept it on the down low for a little while. But I don't know if they had that opportunity or that option. And I probably will have to filter back myself to get some of that backstory on this.
Yeah, Joe, and it's no surprise that the marquee sort of premier free agents and Josh Hamilton and Zach Greinke haven't signed contracts yet. But, I mean, just from what you've seen, has the market for them been developing? And sort of can you give us a little bit in terms of how it's been developing and sort of what you've heard about those guys so far?
You know, it's funny because the Greinke's name has been tossed around a bit more than Hamilton, and I think that The reason why that is because Josh has a little bit of, obviously, some other issues that people are concerned about. The other thing is that there's, you know, Greinke right now is the premier pitcher out there, probably by a good amount. The thing about, not that Hamilton's not a great player, but there's another alternative in center field, in Bourne. And, you know, people seem to be forgetting about him, and he'll probably come at a significantly lower price. Although you start to wonder when, you know, Pagan gets $4 for $40 million and Victorino gets $3 for $39 million, what is Bourne going to get? You know, and probably he's probably looking something in that, you know, that $75 million range now, although I know he originally targeted the $100 million range. And I wouldn't at this point, you know, given how, what you're hearing is, I would not be surprised if Josh Hamilton signs one of these, you know, one-year incentive-laden deals to play somewhere. And I'm not even going to rule – I know other people are. I'm not going to rule out the Rangers on that, because I have a sense the Rangers are having a hard time. You know, they've been linked to Justin Upton a lot this meeting. But, I have a feeling that the Diamondbacks are playing hardball about getting one of their shortstops. And I'm pretty certain that they're not going to trade – you know, Andrews a Profar at this point. So, you know, it's going to be one of these cat and mouse games that's going to go back and forth. But I would not, honestly, would not be shocked if Josh Hamilton's back with the Rangers, even if it's like a one-year type of deal with a lot of incentives or options type of thing.
And so it's kind of been this, it really is a crazy time of the year, and it's a lot of fun to follow. But one of the cooler things that we've seen this week is a number of inductions to the BBWAA, and yourself included. And I'll give you this opportunity to talk a little bit about what it means to you.
Thank you. I'm actually really honored to become a member. There's obviously some great people in this, and some of who, you know, have been my mentors over the years. You know, I've mentioned it publicly, you know, Ken Davidoff was one of my, is one of my favorite writers, and he's given us great feedback and insight for, you know, baseball perspectives and, you know, things that we do. Susan Slusser was very kind to me and to us about, you know, discussing, you know, what the criteria is going forward and trying to help us stay on point, which is great. You know, there's been a lot of great people in this, you know, for over the years, and the opportunity to be in as part of that group, is important to me, but it's more importantly, it's important. It's important to the baseball perspective. And I think that, you know, every day we get more and more, I guess for lack of a better way of saying this, more acknowledged by the mass media, by the public, by the not only just the hardcore fans, but the casual fans, is putting out solid, you know, good content that's really, you know, something that's different, something that's not necessarily beat writing, but it has a lot of analysis, a lot of insight. And the teams are, you know, every day are looking at what we do, and the teams come to us for information, for our thoughts. And, you know, I ran to Jack Zarenik in the hallway with Dan Evans earlier today, and, you know, and Jack had never, I never had met Jack personally, and Dan introduced me to him, and, you know, immediately as who I was, and, you know, from baseball perspectives, and, you know, he's like, you know, immediately got very warm, and, you know, put his arm around. It was like a really nice conversation that, you know, people, it's not baseball perspectives is, you know, recognized by the industry as being, you know, one of the leaders. And I love that feeling, and I love to be able to give back to people. And as I, you know, I'll say this to Hudson because he's part of our group, and excuse me, and to all our other writers out there that, you know, they do all the heavy lifting. You know, there's a lot of work that goes into baseball perspectives. You know, Ben Lindbergh does an incredible job. You know, the tech guys behind the scene do a heck of a lot of work with no credit. You know, Rob McHugh and Colin Wires. And, you know, there's a lot of good stuff that goes on, a lot of good people, and a lot of great baseball minds. And, you know, Dave Pease has been there for a long time and never gets any bit of due for what he's done with baseball perspectives. And yet he's been the lone constant. So I want to thank all those guys and you guys for being supportive of us and of me and what we're trying to do. And there's some other great things coming down the road. And I'm hoping that, you know, everybody will be well received by everybody as well.
Absolutely. And it is a huge honor. And we wish you the most sincere congratulations. And Joe, not to give anything away here, but is there anything new and innovative that we can expect to see from baseball perspective, baseball prospectus in the coming months?
Right. Well, actually, I'll give you a little insight. It took about 15 minutes ahead of time here. We're about to send out a press release and to our subscribers and over, you know, you'll see it on the social media channels. We're going to announce a partnership today with Perfect Game USA to really expand heavily into our minor league and amateur coverage in following the draft and following college and high school players. The development, and we'll be able to, you know, do a lot of different things with these guys, from podcasts to video to scouting analysis, sharing back and forth on their player cards to our player cards, and giving our subscribers and their subscribers even more content. So they'll see the full book on a player from start to finish. So, you know, there'll be a lot of that. There'll be some really cool things that we haven't disclosed with about yet that we're still working on that we want to do together. But to us, it's a really big deal. They're like the leader in the amateur coverage and the showcases and the tournaments. And, you know, they run the Jupiter event every year. And we're just really, really thrilled to be working with these guys. They're, you know, they're top notch. They're smart guys. They all have some connection to baseball. And 85%, I think, of, you know, people that have been drafted, kids that have been drafted over the last a couple of years have gone through their programs, their tournaments, their showcases, so they've seen just about everybody. A lot of them are tied to family members who have played in the game, whether it's be fathers or their sons or brothers or whatever. There's a lot of stuff going on there, and you know, we're really, really excited to be partnering with them and doing some really good things going forward.
And that's just outstanding news. It seems like you mentioned earlier how BP is a respected name in the industry, and I think a lot of the same things apply to BP, to Perfect Game, and to get two giants and mix them together. It's a great idea, and I think it's really awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks. We're really excited about it, too.
So, Joe, we want to give you a chance to plug the Twitter feed, and then we're going to say goodbye, and our listeners will cry, and we'll come back. So,
sure. Well, you can follow, you know, us Baseball Prospectus at Baseball Pro on Twitter. And my personal Twitter is at Jay Hamrahi, J-H-A-M-R-A-H-I. One thing I like to tell everybody is that I'm always up for suggestions. We're in a very open door policy here in terms of what people like to see, like to hear. And I really mean that. I mean, we've taken a lot of the suggestions over the past year or two and really tried to turn it around and give some of our readers what they want. You know, we do the best we can with that, but we're really, you know, open to that. We're always willing to talk baseball, and, you know, we're really excited about that. And you guys can have me on here whenever you want. I'll be happy to come back. So thanks for the opportunity, and keep up the great work.
Thanks a lot.
Oh, you're too sweet, Joe. That was Joe Hamrahi of Baseball Prospectus, and we'll be back with more Tools of Ignorance podcast after this.
Never tell what you wanted from me, babe. I feel you down deep inside.
Welcome back to the Tools of Ignorance podcast. Another huge, huge thanks to Joe Hamrahi for coming on the show. He's a really, really awesome guy, and the hugest of congratulations to him on his induction into the BBWAA. Jonah, we have a couple more things we want to talk about on the show, one of them being Jason Grilli.
Yeah, especially let's only talk about Jason Grilli from 2011 to 2012, because the Jason Grilli that existed in the big leagues for the 9 years prior, is he really relevant at this point?
I don't think so.
No, but it does.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. You know, he's really funny. What's funny really about him is that Gary Sheffield is his agent, and I just can't get over that for some reason.
That is just outstanding.
Yeah, isn't that great?
I could imagine him at the negotiation table. The tactics he pulled out. He wags his bat.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking he would do too. It's just violent wagging of the bat, and then right before the pitch comes, he actually has the same stance as anyone else.
And a huge, huge lipper too.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It looks like he's just had his lip Botoxed.
Oh, he needs it, yeah.
But Jason Grilli is still wading through all the offers presented to him, Sheffield told MLB.com's Tim Sanger. I'm terrible. But that's from MLB Trade Rumors. What do you think of Grilli's prospects of a deal? Do you think he's a guy you give a multi-year contract to?
I mean, at this point, I've become increasingly confident in him. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of giving multi-year contracts to relievers in the first place. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, he's really done a good job to sort of assuage any of the concern that might have existed 3 seasons ago, because he has been absolutely lights out the past 2 seasons working out of the Pirates bullpen. I mean, you look at his strikeout numbers, and they are just, they're video game numbers. I mean, he's thrown 91 in the third innings, and he struck out 127 hitters en route to a 2.76 ERA. And I mean, he didn't throw a whole heap of innings in 2011, over 32. And then in 2012, he threw a significantly bigger load at 60. And the ERA went up a little bit, but, I mean, the strikeout rate climbed too. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he got a 2, maybe even a 3-year deal, but I'd be very, very confident offering him a 2-year contract. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I'd do it. I mean, I wouldn't do it, but the thing is, if I'm going to do it with anyone, he's a good candidate for it, which is a really crappy way of wording everything, but... basically, I don't, like you said, don't believe in giving out multi-year contracts to relievers. There's just so much volatility, and from year to year, there's so much fluctuation from every pitcher. So to give out multi-year deals is a very dangerous game. But we look at Jason Grilli, and this past season was just unreal. If you can continue to physically replicate that for the next 2-3 years, I see no issue with it at all. He's going to be 37 at the end of the deal. If you give him a 2-year contract, yeah, I can definitely dig that.
I mean, the concern at this point has got to be, statistical sustainability. Like, no one can strike, even like the best relievers in the game they can't sustain a 14 strikeout per nine ratio, can they?
I don't know. What's Chapman at? Aroldis Chapman and Kimbrel?
I think he averages 28 strikeouts per nine, if my memory serves.
Chapman was at 15.3 this year. 122 right. strikeouts in 71 innings.
Right, and that's absurd. Like, he is a cyborg. And I don't think that the guy that you would often think of when you're discussing Aroldis Chapman is Jason Grilley. But
I mean, you
look at the numbers, and he certainly, you know, he deserves to be discussed in the same sentence, which is not a thought that I ever thought I would have.
Yeah, and there's one point I want to make. I'm looking at Craig Kimbrell's numbers. The 1.01 ERA is pretty nice. As is the 16.7 strikeouts per nine. But the coolest thing about him is the two walks per nine. And I remember when he was coming up, there was all this talk of, well, he's got to learn to command the strike zone. He can't throw a strike at times. He looks lost. And here he is, 116 strikeouts this season to 14 walks. And he has a chance going forward. He could be one of the better closers of our generation, I think. I think he's got a chance to be that kind of impact player.
Yeah, there's no question about it. Whenever he takes the mound, it's lights out, and it's really a pleasure to watch him pitch. His fastball-slider combination is what dreams are made of. But, I mean, the interesting thing about Grilley is that, I mean, he's not a young guy, and he has, I mean, over the course of his career, he's logged quite a few innings into his arm. He's 36 years old right now, and for some reason, he saw an uptick in velocity last year. I mean, in 2011, when he really found his groove, he was hucking a fastball that averaged 92.4 miles an hour. Last year, I mean, he saw more than a mile per hour increase in velocity. He was throwing it 93.6, so almost 94 on the gun, which is pretty counterintuitive as well, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's weird because but you always wonder about guys as they come back from injuries. How long does it really take to gain all of their velocity back? But even so, Grilley is a guy that's just I remember I didn't have the same type of interaction with him as I did Ryan Vogelsong, but Jason Grilley is a former Lehigh Valley Iron Pig, and I remember him being at least having a good reputation as being a very hardworking player and being, you know, the type of guy who is running stairs 6 hours before the game and, you know, that type of player. So I don't know exactly what it is that's made him, you know, able to do what he's done, but I would imagine that it's probably more so his combination of hard work and effort than it is just coming back from an injury and finally being healthy. But
I don't doubt that. I mean, look at his pedigree, right? His father pitched in the big leagues. Mm-hmm. He was even a Toronto Blue Jay for one game in 1979. He threw 2 1/3 innings. So, yeah, I'm sure makeup is a huge component to that. And, you know, it's not easy to come back from injury and have success and overcome all of those hurdles that are associated with rehabbing and whatnot. But, yeah, I mean, coming back to our original point, it looks like a two-year deal for Grilley seems reasonable. 3 years is getting a little bit silly in our minds because we're not proponents of multi-year deals for relievers that aren't named B.J. Ryan. But, yeah.
Relievers that aren't B.J. Ryan.
Come on, that was the greatest contract ever given. A five-year, $47 million deal to a left-handed closer who throws 89 miles an hour.
But he threw the fastest 89-mile-an-hour fastball I've ever seen.
He did. Him or John Roach?
Yeah. I would say they both would be tied for the fastest 89-mile-an-hour fastball of all time. But, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they're in that conversation, no doubt about it.
Yeah, yeah. They're definitely – it's a conversation. So, quick sidebar. Before we started this segment, we were kind of spitballing ideas of what to talk about. And then I said, let's talk about Jason Grilley for 10 minutes. And I'm not sure exactly where the clock's at now, but we spent a good deal of time doing that.
I think we came pretty close. And if you had told me when we were conceiving of this podcast that we would at one point in time dedicate 10 uninterrupted minutes to Jason Grilley, I would have said, you're crazy.
Yeah, if you told me a decade ago that I would be spending significant time talking about a baseball player, I'd believe you. If you told me that it was Jason Grilley, I'd laugh. So.
Yeah, or cry.
Or cry, yeah. If I, imagining the, like, learning about Jason Grilley, who 10 years ago had appeared in only 7 major league games. And we,
yeah.
Had, yeah, I wouldn't believe it. But
I mean, this is, Jason Grilley had an ERA of 7.4 over 4 or 5 innings in 2004 with the White Sox.
Yeah, that would have definitely brought me to tears. But he only lost 3 games, so.
Good point.
That's win where I would have been.
Win-loss record is the best indication of a pitcher's abilities.
Yeah. What did you think of, or when did you get to the point where you stopped thinking of that? Because I'm not sure I can remember when I stopped thinking that.
When did I become enlightened as to pitching statistics?
Yeah.
I'd say probably in the past 2 to 3 years.
Really?
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Late bloomer.
Yeah, yeah.
When did you? You probably did it out of the fetus. You were like, you were born. You're like, no. See, I know Brett Cecil had 14 wins in 2009, but he's not very good.
Well, I didn't do it so much with wins as I did. I dismissed RBIs almost immediately, and then I dismissed a bunch of other counting stats.
Immediately in terms of what?
I never accepted it.
Like ever?
Never. I never thought of RBIs as a thing. I remember when I did play Little League and I got an RBI and someone congratulated me and I totally didn't
want any
credit. You
punched them in the face.
Yeah, it was like I did nothing. so yeah, I never accepted RBIs. I would never cited them as an evidence of anything. Now
I just feel stupid and I am a Luddite, as Keith Law would say.
Luddite.
But I've been enlightened, I assure you.
Yeah, if you're very far along, I would say, after being you're basically a child in sabermetrician ways. But I think wins was probably like 7th or 8th grade. I got to the point where I was like, "Come on, that's not really anything."
Really?
Yeah. I read Moneyball in middle school, and that kind of Moneyball led to Baseball Between the Numbers, which opened up Pandora's box and became a BP subscriber and all that.
Your baseball scholarship, it's like you, like for the baseball equivalent, you were like reading at a college sophomore level when you were like 8 years old. So that's pretty impressive.
It's just this weird thing that I have. I can't explain why I found this stuff so fascinating at such a young age, but I basically closed off all other academic endeavors and was just baseball for like 10 years of my life. So that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, now I want to backtrack and say, like, no, I knew wins were stupid when I was 3.
Yeah, I would. I knew that. I wish I was reading BP when it first started. When did BP start? I'm not sure I was
alive.
Let's
get Joe back on the phone, though.
I don't know if I was alive.
Call him up!
Do you want to?
No,
he's at the winter meeting.
We bugged him enough for one day. He was gracious enough. I don't want to push our luck.
Yeah, yeah. We have bugged him enough. But, Jonah, is there any other burning issue going on right now in baseball that you'd like to discuss?
Well, now I'm fixated on this one issue of my own enlightenment. Like I'm trying to really remember when I realized that wins were a poor way of assessing a pitcher's abilities. Because like I don't have any vivid memory of like a light bulb going on, but I also can't remember any time in recent memory of being like, yeah, wins are totally reflective of how successful a pitcher's been.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm in my own head and I'm thinking that it might have been earlier than I said, but that could also mean just being embarrassed. So I don't know. You've caused me to be insecure, Hudson.
When have you read Moneyball?
Yes.
When did you read that?
Before the movie came out.
Yeah. So I would imagine it was on my mantle for years,
and I can't remember when I picked it up, but it was in my bathroom for a long time, and finally I got to reading. But this was a number of years ago now.
Yeah, my Moneyball story. A girlfriend at the time, and I went to a Barnes & Noble to pick up a book for her mother, and we saw Moneyball, and we got Moneyball, and she has been long gone, but Moneyball has stayed with me. So yeah, wasn't that a very romantic baseball moment?
That was touching. I'm touched.
But yeah, could you imagine if I picked up like Twilight or something?
Well, yeah, you omitted the second part of the story where you went back and then purchased that when you finished Moneyball.
Oh yeah, this is true. I haven't finished Moneyball yet. I have a couple pages left, so I'll finish it and then I'll go to Barnes & Noble, get another book, and live a completely different life.
Absolutely.
Jonah, yeah. What's going on in your life for the next several days?
The next several days, I got finals coming up, my man. I was still fortunate enough to churn out 700 words that actually happened to be featured on Jeff Perlman's website, which was kind of a big thrill for me. So I got to write a little bit about the Blue Jays and get some people to read my thoughts on the upcoming season, which was very exciting. And so there was that. And, now we're buckling down for finals and, of course, always being very steadfast and diligent in the performance of our BP internship duties. And how about you, Mr. Belinsky?
Yeah. The Jeff Perlman stuff, that's just totally, totally awesome. And really, really happy for you on that front.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. For me, it's more of the same. It's writing about baseball. I wrote something on, what country are you from?
It's pronounced Canada.
I wrote something about that place today, or not today, it came out today. I'm very, very proud of what I wrote. I put a lot of work into it.
Yeah, it really was a sensational piece, and anyone who's interested in getting a sense of how the evolution of baseball scouting in Canada has sort of gone down, you really, it's a must-read, because it really was a fantastic piece.
Well, thank you, sir, but... yeah, I talked to a lot of people for it, and I didn't use I get to sometimes, this doesn't happen to me often, but there are times when I've collected way too much information, and then I've got these guys who actually, especially with this article, care about what's being written and want their names in the article, and so it was a very odd position to be in, to have talked to people who I respect the hell out of, and then to not quote them, and it was weird. I don't know, or not to go, not even use their information. So, but there were a lot more things that I did not include in the article because they weren't really conclusive. But one very interesting thing that I found was that no team has taken more than two. Only one team has taken two, but two Canadians that turned out to be 10 WARP players or higher since the Canadians have been eligible for the draft. And that was the Twins. They took Corey Koski and Justin Morneau. And so I found it very interesting that while some teams are investing more time and money in Canada, there's not clearly a team that's doing better in Canada.
Yeah, and just some looking at the statistics that you provided, naturally, well, I mean, you could argue if it actually makes sense or not, but Toronto obviously drafts Canadians at a disproportionate rate, but they haven't necessarily seen a huge return on those Canadian draft picks. And I mean, you look at the preeminent Canadian in their organization right now in Brett Laurie, and he wasn't drafted by the team. So that, which I thought was an interesting little factoid.
Yeah, and what was interesting about Laurie, the Brewers took Laurie, and the Brewers, since Doug Melvin has been in town, have been the second most active team in Canada. So that's interesting that he went from the team that drafts the second most Canadians to the team that drafts the most. But another thing that I found interesting was the scene of baseball in Canada and scouting, and how the club scene is so intense, and following these kids is actually very easy because they're all on the same junior national team, all of the top follow. So it's kind of, you get to see that everyone gets to see the talent, so it's very difficult to hide prospects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, in that sense, it's good for exposure. You know, the scouts know where the players are going to be, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then that related a little bit to the scout that signed Ferguson Jenkins was a guy named Tony Lucadello, and he had a reputation as being this crazy great scout. He would go find kids all over the place and for some reason know that there was something in them that nobody else could see. And he also signed Mike Schmidt, and he just a very excellent reputation as a scout. But today, he probably wouldn't have been able to just go find Ferguson Jenkins and sign him and get him. So, and that's kind of Ferguson Jenkins' fault, because, you know, he inspired so many kids to play baseball in Canada, and now it's kind of taken off, and it's this big sport that everyone can do, and yay.
Yeah, it's no longer that sort of untapped resource. People know about it, but don't give away anything else. I implore you, go read the piece at baseballperspectives.com. You won't be disappointed. It's really a sensational piece of work.
Thank you very much, Jonah. And, Jonah, I think it's time for us to transition into the final seconds of our show. Do you have any final thoughts for our listeners, other than where they can email us?
Right. Again, thank you for reminding me, Hudson. But, yeah, if you guys have any questions, we really love to answer them on the show. So please get them into toolsofignorance11@gmail.com. Once again, we really want you to get your questions in, because, you know, we want to address things that you guys want to hear about. So please don't hesitate to fire us an email.
Okay, Jonah, I think it's time to say goodbye.
Parting is such sweet sorrow.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back with more podcasts next week.